Welcome back to Magnum Podcast. I'm Jason Snell. I'm here with David J. Lohr and Philip Michaels, as usual. Hi, guys.
Aloha, aloha, aloha.
Must waste Snell.
Oh, no. Oh, no, don't waste me yet until I've injected something in you. But first, let's introduce our guest, our very first guest on the Magnum Podcast. Yes, believe it or not, somebody wanted to be on this podcast. And it's Anthony Johnston, who insisted to be on our episode about Did You See the Sunrise? Anthony, welcome.
Stop calling me Higgy. That was only barely more realistic accent than the real one.
I was going to say, John Hellerman's English accent, your thoughts?
it's good enough that when I was a kid, I bought it. Like, as an adult, you can hear, and especially obviously now, you know, knowing real Americans and things, you can hear that it is put on, but it is a lot better than many I have heard in the intervening time.
All right.
I don't know if I can't remember if I mentioned this in the far canon of our episodes so far, which number, what, four?
Yeah, but this is number five, so sure, think back.
Deep cut.
The characterization became so famous that he had to do commercials in the Higgins character, because he was doing Monoloa Macadamia Nuts commercials.
Right.
And nope, you're not using your real voice. Use that fake British
accent. Oh, but that happens all the time, though. Idris Elba, when all anybody knew him for was playing Stringer Bell, did the same thing, had to do interviews and stuff in his American accent because people just wouldn't believe that he was British.
I mean, I remember when Hillerman was on One Day at a Time back in the 70s using his own voice. And I mean, he's in Blazing Saddles.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Howard Johnson is right.
He was a Texan, wasn't he?
No.
Yes, he was.
It was.
Yeah.
But
not known for their light accent.
When this started, it was like, wait a second, that's pretty good for him, because I remembered his voice. And, and my friends at school would be like, no, he's English, isn't he? Nope.
That's what you get when you hire an actor.
Mm. One of the things, there's so much to talk about this 2-hour third season premiere, Didn't You See the Sunrise, written by the show's co-creator, but really showrunner, Donald Bellisario. But I want to start, since we're talking about Higgins, as I'm revisiting all these old episodes for this podcast, I was thinking today, I was sort of musing as I'm watching Higgins relay messages from Rick and say that Magnum needs an answering service, and Magnum responding, I already have one, as he builds his bridge on the River Kwai. I thought, one of the things I like about this is that it takes kind of like detective tropes, whether it's a noir detective or even like a Sherlock Holmes kind of thing, and then it plays with them and it does some inversions. And I like Higgins is kind of a sidekick, but he's not. And he is kind of Magnum's butler, but he's not. He's someone else's butler, but Magnum is there. And I think that's one of the things I really love about Higgins, is that he embodies a bunch of kind of like tropes or stereotypes of like characters you'd find in a mystery story, except not properly, because of this weird thing where he's like the major domo, but he works for Robin Masters, and then Magnum just happens to be kind of the squatter on the property. It struck me again that like Higgins is helpful when he needs to be and trouble when he needs to be, but he's like he's kind of like Watson or something like that, except not.
Yeah, he's kind of a conscience and a sounding board. And you know, I mean, I love the idea that if Magnum is doing security, then quote unquote, the sidekick is kind of his boss.
He's the mother. Yeah,
exactly.
He's the mother character. You know, and Bellisario, God knows, every Bellisario series has this, like, you know, surrogate family dynamic in its cast of characters. And in this one, Higgins is the mother figure.
And this is one of the few episodes where he's vaguely nice to Magnum. So that's
yeah, right. Yeah.
although Higgins starts talking over
war things, which is also a Bellisario trademark, as we all know. You know, it's we can all have our differences, but war, well, that brings men together.
And this is the thing that is slightly bothers me about the Higgins character, is he's talking about his time in Burma during World War II. John Hillerman would have been 10.
Then. Yeah, it's like, how old are you exactly? Yeah.
When did you enlist?
Well, Higgins is a
17-year-old Lance Corporal, I guess.
A lot of young men lied about their age to enlist.
Sure.
That's my headcanon now. Higgins doesn't have a lot to do other than take the relay messages from Rick to Magnum in this episode, except he, he yells at Magnum and TC for landing the helicopter on the grounds. But really, he's totally focused on building the bridge on the River Kwai out of matchsticks in this episode. That is, Anthony, you're totally right. That is the war. Shared memories of war bring us together thing. Although I do love the moment where Magnum totally deduces using his Sherlock like powers of deduction that he's going to be using all the match heads to do his little miniature cannons, and then Higgins just throws him in the trash. My head cannon there is that's totally what he was going to use them for, but he's not going to give Magnum the pleasure.
Well, I love this. I actually wrote this down. You know, the idea that in 2 years, right, Don Bellisario wrote the pilot where he's like, you know, how are you going to know, Magnum? I'll know it when I see it. That's every clue in the pilot is I'll know it when I see it. And this, two years later, he's managed to get to a point where Magnum actually makes a really, really smart deduction based on knowledge. And Higgins says it's wrong, and maybe it is, maybe it's not. But still, the fact that he was able to make that deduction is just kind of cool.
But then for the rest of the episode, he does pretty much do "I'll know it when I see it."
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Well, he it's not his fault. He's not even on a case for half the show.
No, true.
Right, and then it's just chasing.
That is one of the things I like about this episode is that we actually don't see anything of Ivan apart from like those couple of small flashbacks until there's only 30 minutes left in the show before he actually turns up, and I like that because it really helps sort of build him up as a villain.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. It's like the third man. Everyone thinks Orson Welles is in the whole movie. He's in it for like 8 minutes.
Yeah, he's using a rifle to shoot a poor line. Well, he's not actually a lineman, right? He's a spy. He's working for the Navy or whatever. But he shoots that poor guy up there. That was something that I remembered from my childhood.
He knew
I was like,
the
oh,
risks.
God. Yeah, he
did. I'm not getting paid enough for this gig.
Nope. Jumping back to the River Kwai for a second, though, one of the things that is so interesting is that he's got references to Stalag 17. The bridge on the River Kwai. It's all of these prisoner of war things.
Yep.
Higgins talks about escaping. It's a good thing I escaped before they destroyed it. And then the story that he starts to tell about this Lieutenant Bumgardner who helped him escape. And my brain just went, that's James Garner's real name. James Garner was in The Great Escape. That's another weird little reference that he threw in just for kicks.
Well spotted.
Mm. And I just thought,
to the lads.
Nice.
I think the difference here compared to like the third man is that we know these characters. We've been following them for, you know, three seasons now. And so it's seeing their reactions. We know them as, you know, derring do, happy go lucky heroes, and seeing them genuinely afraid of a bogeyman has much more of an impact than something in, say, you know, Harry Lime in The Third Man or something.
And I mean, I don't remember for certain since we're not watching these in order, but, you know, even though we knew that they had a past in Vietnam, I think this is the first time we had any idea that they were POWs for any length of time.
Oh, is it? Right.
I think so.
This is the only episode.
Unless it came up in the Michelle episodes in season two.
Might have.
Yeah, this is the first episode that I've watched apart from the pilot pretty much since it was first broadcast.
Oh, wow.
Well, we got it a year in the UK. We got it a year after the US. So I would have seen this. So it started showing in 81 when I was 9, and my mom watched it because she fancied Tom Selleck, because, you know, who doesn't?
Well, yeah.
And so I was allowed to stay up and watch it with her when I was a kid. And I would have been 11 years old when this one aired. And honestly, it's the only episode I remember. Like, I could not, you could tie me down and I wouldn't be able to tell you a single detail from any other episode of Magnum, but I remember this one because at 11 years old, it blew my tiny little mind.
Well,
you know?
it's so memorable when you have the main character of your show just gun down someone, not because he's under attack, as Ivan doesn't say, well, if I were coming at you with a gun, you could shoot me, but you could not shoot me unarmed. Well, spoiler alert,
because
I can.
Magnum kills people all the time in the show, but it's always like in the heat of the moment and all of that. And this is the one that it blew all our minds. In fact, this is one of those things where because we lived in a gentler age, an age where people weren't online, and unless you had a friend who also watched the show, who you could talk about the show with at school the next day. That would be a Friday in the U.S. because it's aired on Thursdays. A Friday, if you had a friend, you could talk about it. But otherwise, my experience with this episode is I got to, I don't know, college or after, and occasionally, randomly, Magnum P.I. would come up and somebody would be, oh, you remember that one where you see the sunrise and he shoots the guy? And you mentioned this and people's eyes get wide and they're like, oh, because back then, like, it made this impression on so many people. And it's not the only one I remember, because as we detailed here, I remember apparently every single shot in that Luther Gillis episode. I don't know why. but yeah, absolutely. In fact, when I watch this back, what I'm amazed by is, of course, the part that's burned in our brains is literally the last 5 seconds of the episode. And then it's like, what is the storyline that gets up to that point? And it's, to be honest, it's Magnum.
It's Magnum, not the best.
Vietnam intrigue.
No, it's twisty in a bad way.
Yeah, Vietnam intrigue is not ever my favorite aspect of Magnum. The whole thing with Michelle, like all of this, the Lance LeGault stuff, like it's not my favorite.
Lance LeGault, I do.
But in this episode with the POW stuff and them being tortured and all of that, I think that I think it's much more effective than like the pilot episode where it turns out that, you know, their French friend is actually a, you know, a drug runner and dies in the Honolulu Airport. Report, as we've detailed here, but yeah. What I'm saying is I thought the Vietnam stuff is way more effective here, where there's this all this tension of them running through the jungle and trying to hide and pulling their wounded buddy with them, who turns out is a Russian spy. That was a great twist that I didn't entirely remember. Like that part of it, I think, is really effective.
Yeah. Well, and the whole Manchurian candidate thing, I'd forgotten that as well.
Yes.
Right. I mean, It might be the only really successful Vietnam episode they did, because it's again, it surprises you, right? We're not used to them not just immediately breaking out and saving themselves. And, you know, we have to think, okay, this is 10 years earlier. They're not quite those people yet, right? They're still growing. And yeah, you have this really good villain. Whereas in the other Vietnam episodes, they're usually kind of on top of things and they were just there.
Well, yeah. I think part of the reason he's a good villain is because he's really underdeveloped, and that actually works to his advantage, because it's the whole, you know, like the thing about you never see the shark and all that sort of stuff. Don't show the monster. Because we see so little of him, it actually is more effective than, villains in other, as you say, other Vietnam episodes, of not just this show as well, of other shows as well.
And we see the impact he has on the characters, because TC is rattled. TC is unhinged throughout the episode. TC is never unhinged.
true. One, like, the thought of, as soon as I saw Belisario's name, I went, oh, okay. And that early part of the first half is very much what we think of as Magnum now, right? He's got it. He's figured it out. He's dialed it in. They're funny. They're joking. And, you know, TC and Magnum are very loose and they're teasing Higgins and, oh, you know, funny stuff is happening.
Well, you've got that thing at the hula club and,
date that...
But that's that has nothing to do with TC. I have a point. I actually have a point. Is that...
Everybody stand back. David's got a point.
Stand back. Here it comes. Stand back. I'm going to blow. Wait, no, I'm not even in a Ferrari. It's to show not just that, hey, I figured out how to write this show, but it's to show that clear shift when TC is around Nuzo and suddenly he's like a zombie.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And that's a very – it's actually pretty subtle for third season Magnum how they make that shift. And it's plausible.
The thing I have to get across to you guys, which is quite difficult, it's kind of hard to explain, is Vietnam was not a quote unquote our war. Like,
right.
I didn't even know where Vietnam was. Nobody my age in England knew where it was. We knew nothing about the war. I'm not sure I'd even heard of the Vietnam War until Magnum. I think this may have been first show that came over that featured a hero who was a primetime action show, I mean, that featured a hero who was a Vietnam vet. And then, of course, we got this influx of loads of shows, Miami Vice, the A-Team, obviously, loads of shows where the heroes were all suddenly Vietnam veterans. And we were like, what's a Vietnam veteran? Where is Vietnam? What does this mean? It was all so weird for us.
But this really was the first show to not only address it, but to be a success.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
It was the first Vietnam
which is why
vet.
It was the first one that made it over to the UK. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cause you had Vietnam in popular culture in like 1970s movies, like Coming Home or, The Stuntman, where, it kind of covers the trauma of the war, but Magnum was the first to just sort of be, well, these are regular guys and this was their experience, and some of those experiences weren't great, like when they were tortured by a Russian agent in a prison camp.
Yeah. I wasn't watching war movies when I was 6 years old, strangely right. enough.
No, I think this is true. I think this was thinking of now again as a kid at the time, I didn't even understand it, but like you're not too long after the Vietnam War, and you've got these people who are just your regular, you know, it's your regular characters on the show, but they all, their connection is through Vietnam, and they're in Hawaii, so they got the Navy and all of that going on. And then you see something like this where, yeah, they were prisoners and they were tortured and all of that. And yeah, absolutely. This is one of the shows where that was really first done. And I think here, as silly as the TC they made TC a sleeper agent so that yeah. 7 years later they could kill the Japanese prince or whatever.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that plot when we get there.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll get there.
So as silly as that is, what I like about it is we see Nuzo and he's messed up, except it turns out that he's actually, this is all a ploy.
Well,
but then he messes up TC. and as silly as aspects of that story are, what I got out of it as an adult watching it is, this is a show, and I remember this from the time, it's like, this is a show that's not afraid of basically saying, yeah, you know, people come back from war, they're really messed up. Like, and Magnum struggles yeah. with it a little bit, and it's a light touch, or it's a silly kind of plot device, but like, you can't watch Did You See the Sunrise without saying, this is an American mainstream action adventure show that has something to say about PTSD. And I think it's just mm-hmm. kind of remarkable yeah. that it's in here, because that's a tough one. And I think I was impressed that this is actually portraying it and saying, these guys came back and they're kind of broken, and you don't know from looking at the surface how broken they might be, without it being like a, you know, until the end, it's not like a very special episode of Magnum and then he shoots a guy. And it is, but like, well, I think very well handled.
And they don't laugh it off, you know, as funny as parts right. of the episode are, they don't make a joke of it and they don't treat it lightly. They say, you know what, you can get past it to survive. You can go on with your life, but it is still there. And when it comes up, it, you know, not always a good thing.
And they don't treat the Navy lightly blown up and
that's what turns him.
Right.
And doesn't just, and it is a dog by episode two. He's all, oh, all right, I better go avenge my friend's death. It's like, he's still very traumatized by it.
I mean, just the idea that he's counting sunrises.
Right.
Even at the time, I loved that as a detail. That was one of those things that stuck in my head on the writer's side of, you know, ooh, that's really nicely done.
Yeah, the whole thing is, as you say, it's not, none of it is done, none of it is thrown away. You know, it's not labored, but it's also treated, you know, fairly seriously. And yeah, as I say, the Navy aspect of it is treated with more gravity perhaps than some episodes of Magnum, but again, you can probably just put that down to Belisario, you know,
right?
The man is obsessed. he has a story and he's going to tell it many, many times and pretty much in the same style every time as well, and you know, that's fine, it's a good story.
And I mean, I kind of like Buck Green. I like him because he's terrible,
man,
right?
He's
I love how Like, at, you know, when he shows up at the hospital and he pulls up and he parks under two no parking anytime signs. And then as he gets out, the camera zooms in to emphasize that. It's like, And then when he, well, like, Lieutenant Poole leaves and you see his eyes literally just go, hey, nice ass. And it's like, he is so awful. But my grandfather, during the first part of the Vietnam War, he was working at the Pentagon. So I was very aware of the Vietnam War as a child. And we watched this and he said, first of all, the Vietnam sequences were damn effective, unquote, but that, yes, he knew a lot of men like Buck Green and that rang true to him. Hmm. And I was like, well, all right.
Oh, no, that was my problem with Buck Green is that generally it wasn't a great episode when he was
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
This,
yeah.
this is an exception.
Right, because they were Navy or conspiracy of history yeah. or kind of stuff, which is not the show's, at least not my favorite part of the show either. Right.
Although right. in college I had a friend who named his sports rec team Lance LeGault's Heroes, so.
Excellent. Yeah, no, that mean, was. I just remembered the other thing I was going to say about sort of treating it seriously was, of course, that the whole business with the Japanese ambassador and that line from the admiral about how even hated enemies in time can eventually become friends, which yes. is it kind of, you know, delivered as a punchline almost to the conversation he has with Buck Green. But it also, again, without belaboring the point, kind of emphasizes, oh yeah, all these young men go through this and come back broken. And obviously Japanese Vietnam, different, but still, you know, in the eyes of 1980s Western television, it's all Asia. So it's kind of, yeah, you know, it. What was it all really for? Probably nothing.
This is a show, I mean, it's an early 80s show, again, action-adventure. It's a show written largely by men about men. I wanted to mention a couple of things that I noticed about this. In each episode, or in each hour, because this aired as a 2-hour premiere. It got yeah. carved up into 1 hours for syndication. There is a woman character that I was, again, you know, I watch these and I'm like, oh boy, let's see how this goes. That I was impressed. So in the first one, we get Julie, who is Magnum's date with Mac, tagging along, which is just, it's funny. They're at the tourist luau. She's rolling her eyes.
Luau
Louis. It makes me laugh because it's very much like, you know, we're going to the tourist trap for this because Mac likes the drinks. The you can eat the pineapple that's got all the booze in it and all that, which is hilarious. But what I like about Julie is that Julie's rolling her eyes at the beginning. I'm like, oh boy, you know, because it's like, oh, what a date this is, Magnum. And then by the end, she's having a good time, and Magnum is not having a good time. And I like that it twists it a little bit, and it's like Magnum's actually kind of the stick in the mud here, and she's found, like Mac, she's found the kind of joy in the silly tourist luau destination. And and then in the second part, yeah, there's Lieutenant Maggie Poole, who is absolutely the target of sexism, and it's commented on in the episode. And it's commented that Mac was a good guy because he didn't make a pass at her and he treated her with respect, and that, you know, she kind of talks to Magnum about how she's treated by these jerks who are the men in the Navy. And again I had that, like, oh, look at that, like this show is, She's not there to be the sexy lady naval officer in this episode. She is there dealing with Lance LeGault's crap. But it's in both of those characters,
really well,
I was like, oh, thank goodness that these women aren't treated horribly. It's not a show with a female point of view by any means, but I think they're treated well, and I was relieved.
Well, moment where, you know, she's supposed to drive Magnum home, and then as they're driving, she goes, would you look like you could use a drink at the officers' club? And there's that pause, and he goes,
who put you up
you're
to
put
it?
Up to this.
Was
you
the
know,
admiral
how
or Green.
Far was it supposed to go? And she says, just one drink. And he goes, I'm glad that it was just going to be one drink. And she goes, you're making fun of me. And he goes, no, I actually am glad that, you know, that you weren't going to go that far.
Yeah.
And that was just a really nice, enlightened kind of moment for 1983, 1984.
And this is Jean Bruce Scott's first appearance as that mm-hmm. character, isn't it? And I'd completely forgotten that she was in this, but where I do remember her from is Airwolf.
Right.
Which she was in for, I think, two seasons, where she I mean, yes, she was the pretty girl sidekick, but she was also a pilot in her own right and regularly gave crap back to Stringfellow Hawk and all that, you know, and stood up for herself. So, you know, maybe this was, and that was a Belisario show as well, of course. So maybe this was some kind of audition.
And well, over the course of her time on Magnum, because she's in 10 episodes, she gets promoted. She becomes lieutenant commander after a while.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah. And it always amused me that he wrote this episode to kill off Max so he could free up Jeff McKay for Tales of the Gold Monkey.
Yep.
And then introduces Maggie Poole and just goes, "Eh, you can be an Airwolf too. I don't have to kill her off." I was like, yeah. What's that about?
Yeah. Well, and it turns out that Jeff McKay just comes back as we haven't dealt with any of that. Like, there's Max identical cousin comes back later.
So bizarre.
Kind of squibbing the shock of Max's death here. He does die.
There is actually an episode called Max Back, and it's just that Magnum sees a guy who just happens to look exactly like him, and then becomes obsessed with finding out who he is, and then says, "Even though your name is Jim Bonnick, I'm going to call you Max."
Oh my
god. It's a little disturbing.
Yeah. It's really strange. Yeah. That was by the end when they were going, "We just want to work with Jeff McKay.
He will be my best friend.
We can't unkill you,
I will call him Mac and I will love him and I will keep him in the Ferrari with me at all times.
And he will never blow up
and
again.
Never again. So another thing I wanted to mention, talking about modern sensibility and 1982, when this episode aired. Here's the thing. Ivan calls TC by a very, very bad word on network television multiple times.
Yes. And such a bad word that I don't think any of us want to use that.
No, we don't.
No.
But
you can guess what it would be.
Yeah.
And this is actually my thought, which is, you know, a drama in 2020 on network TV where somebody is saying that word to a black man, a white person, in this case a Russian, an evil Russian agent, but still a white person, saying to a black person that word. And I thought they'd be like, no, we can't use that word. You just can't use that word. And I thought, I'm kind of okay with it in Magnum here, because you know what? He's a really bad guy and he's pushing their psychological buttons, and it's not,
right.
I and forgive me for this tangent here, but sometimes I just saw this about, what was it? How there were people who were watching the Paul Cornell episode of Doctor Who where he goes back to 1917, and he's a teacher at a school, and his companion is Martha. She's black and she's treated horribly, and it's just by racists in England in 1914 or 1912. And I saw a few people go by and say, "I can't watch that episode because of the racism in it." And I thought, but it's historic racism, and if you don't portray it, then you whitewash it. And that's how I feel a little bit about this, which is I kind of appreciate the fact that Ivan uses that word with TC, because he's super evil, cartoonishly evil, torturing Russian guy, and he's supposed to be psychologically torturing all of them. And so when he keeps using that word, I know we wouldn't use it today, but I'm like, well, this is shocking, but he's a really bad dude, so I'm okay with it.
And it's supposed to get under all of their skins, right?
Yes,
this
absolutely.
Is a team.
But still, the other part of me is like, wow, 8 p.m. on Thursday night on CBS?
Well, it was still 9 p.m.
In 1982. Okay, 9 p.m. This was 9 to 11, David?
I think
so, was this 8
yeah.
to 10? Okay, all right.
Yeah. But yeah, and I mean, they make a point of saying a couple of times that he went overboard. You know, what did he do to TC? What did he do to you guys? Right. He had to have been extreme.
Right.
Right. So they sort of make an excuse for it. But still, they let it.
It's also shorthand for the more extreme forms, because you're not going to show some of the maybe more extreme forms
of
torture.
Really,
but you can get it across pretty quickly that he is a bad guy who is psychologically trying to destroy these guys.
Now, I was amused when he does kill one of the team. And he shoots their gunner up.
No!
He shoots Cookie in apparently his package of red paint. It just punctured that, and I don't know why he died, because it was just red paint, but it was a lot of red paint.
Well, he couldn't get his thumb to... He was really touched that red paint.
It was red paint in his femoral artery, I mean, you know.
If only I had my palate! Oh!
R.I.P. Cookie. Never forget.
Not a great blood effect.
No. Also a character in Stalag 17, just while
yes.
we're
Yeah. Well, that's why it has that resonance for Magnum. But we don't. They don't spell it out clearly.
So
in the moment, so it's later you hear that.
Did any of you take that line from Ivan, the word from Ivan, and I mean, did it strike you like me, or did you go, "Oh, wow, that's like too far. Don't do that." I was struck by how it's different.
I had forgotten that they use that. My wife was watching the episode with me and actually gasped.
Yeah.
That 1982. What you can no. No, was... what are you doing? But I think it was a very deliberate choice again to emphasize how terrible Russian Buford Pusser is.
Yep. He's a bad guy. And then he killed Cookie.
This isn't the guy from Walking Tall. He's a meanie.
I'll tell you, that moment later on where we flash back, because we flash back in the first hour to the prison camp thing where they're held in the little bamboo things hanging from the tree and all that. We come back for one quick flashback in the second part, and it's such a great moment. It's so well done because we've seen the women in the rice paddy pointing at them across the river. And that was the one where we left it, is that she was basically going to point out where they were and Ivan was going to come get them. And in the second flashback in the second hour, she points right at them and he like looks out that way and then points a totally different direction and they go that way. And it's so great because that's the moment where you're like, oh, I see what's happening. I thought it was really effective in that moment of like, this has all been, and part of my brain's going, really? It's all been a setup since 1972? Okay. Yeah. All right.
Well,
okay.
They do paper over it a little by saying that he wasn't the only one, you know, that this was something they did regularly with lots of people.
And they didn't know how they would use him, but they'd find a way. Right. I get all of that, but I love that moment where it's like, you know, of course Ivan's going to go get them. And then he knows where they are and doesn't go get them. And you're like, oh no. Yeah. Oh no.
Right.
And this is the second episode we've watched just in this podcast run where Magnum has figured out a clue by watching old movies.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say
this is Magnum solving things before TCM came along. I mean, TCM, he'd be the greatest detective in the world because every movie that came along, it solved the case again.
Mm-hmm. No,
he'd watched The Manchurian Candidate.
My memory is that Magnum spent a lot of time on that couch watching TV, and that was kind of his place where he worked things over in his head and figured things out.
Yeah.
Also, by the way, this episode answers the question that you had, I think either in the last episode or the one before, about Eyewitness. He does have a VCR on that estate.
Mm-hmm.
He can tape things, and he does stay up after midnight.
Yeah.
Or rather, he doesn't stay up after midnight. So what was he doing at 2 a.m. watching baseball? But that's a whole, you know.
Eyewitness is such a
weird episode. The only things he'll stay up for midnight for are his videotape of Stalag or the live baseball from Japan.
Live on tape.
I don't even, you're making me so angry again. So angry.
But I do like how all the flashbacks set that up. Right. So we have that early on and we know, oh, well, this is what's happening. And then he's trying to think it through of, hang on, how did he track us? He didn't seem to be the best tracker back in Vietnam. And then we get to see him thinking through that and going, oh,
yeah.
And again, it's very nicely. They don't belabor it. They don't spell it out 20 times. They let you figure that part out as he does.
Yeah, may not be much of a tracker, but he's a hell of a sniper.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, guy up on the telephone pole. The Wichita lineman is still on the line.
But it went clean through.
He's going to be fine. He just cut and drop, and you'll be okay.
Maybe he broke his leg in the fall.
That's actually not a bad action sequence, right? Like where Magnum has to tumble out of the van, and then he's getting shot at, and he goes behind the van, and then he tells the guy to drop, and then they cover
it's
up.
It's certainly
and then
better than when TC and Nuzo go into the compound. With some of the worst security I've ever seen at a military base.
Oh my god!
And kills dozens of people.
Yes, please.
Well, so we have the excuse that TC is in the reserves, so that gives at least a little bit of hand waving to how he gets in.
Even so, there's no barrier. There's two guys who,
again, I want to complain about the Russians' planning here, because their great plan is, yes, we brainwashed a guy 7 years ago. We're going to use him to get the Japanese prince. Now, never mind, we apparently have no sleeper agents in Japan where it would be much easier and more convenient to kill him. We're going to bust through a military the reserve station where everyone is presumably heavily armed. Our drugged assassin is going to be able to fly a plane. He's so drugged he thinks he's back in Vietnam, but no, he can operate a helicopter. That'll be fine. It'll take him so much time to get to the attack site that no other helicopters to shoot him out of the sky can be deployed.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people shepherding the Japanese prince are all, oh, we better go hide inside this building. The helicopter can't get us in there.
Apart from that one guy who pulls his revolver.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he's going to shoot the helicopter down. I want to mention also, because you've left it at the moment, the critical moment where they talk TC out of it, when they could probably have just blown up the helicopter and that would be the end of TC. It is after that where TC shakes his head and he's like, oh, Tom, is that you? Oh, yeah, let's go back to base, buddy. And I'm like, no. You see that grass over there? Just land the helicopter and get out. They're like, no, hey, you're high as a kite and we're just about to kill the Japanese prince. Why don't we fly back to the other side of the island? Yeah, I'm sure he's fine now.
But also, like, when they do get in there, I know there's a lot of they keep switching back and forth between, you know, what TC's imagining and what's really happening. But as far as I could see, anyway, Nuzo genuinely does kill at least a dozen reserve soldiers base.
Yes.
It's absolute carnage. And I'm like, at this point, why didn't they just bomb the place on a suicide mission? Uh-huh. It would have been easier.
And why doesn't he get on the helicopter with TC either? He's like,
well,
and then
he assumes it's going to get shot down.
And then you're going to get, then you're going to put your hands up. I don't know. It seems like he doesn't have a way out either, which is very weird too. But,
very poor planning. This is not what I expect from Russian intelligence.
Okay.
I successfully killed Anwar Sadat, apparently.
Yes.
Quite a serious allegation to be leveling there, Donald Belisario.
Well, he's a Sadat truther, and you can't avoid it. I wanted to mention, let's see, what else is going on here? Oh, here's the thing. I believe in the original broadcast version of this in 1982, it's actually I Can't Get No Satisfaction that's playing on the radio.
No.
I believe. But,
no.
Of course, in the version that we have, it very definitely is not.
Oh,
you mean it's a cover version, yeah.
Any Glenn Larson shows, any Universal shows, they did not pay for the actual version.
So they always
had
a really bad cover where the guy over-enunciates. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Lauren's comment while we were watching this was, I'm surprised they paid for the composition and didn't just have it be, but it has like a Vietnam flavor, which is why they do it. I mean,
right.
They might as well have done Painted Black, but they do that.
They should have.
And I was a little surprised that they didn't completely cheap out and he's just listening to some smooth atonal jazz. But he's not. He's listening to
honestly, I was impressed. I was impressed that they paid for several scenes from Stalag 17 because that's not a Universal property.
Interesting.
And it's like, right. So whatever clearances they paid, that was for that.
They got it for William Holden.
But yeah, Universal never used actual songs.
Can I ask, as the ignorant Englisher, what is the weird connection between Vietnam and the Stones? Because Tour of Duty had Paint It Black as the actual theme song, didn't it?
I think it's just because it sounds good. It sounds harsh.
And
it
they
doesn't
were,
sound like...
And they
know.
Were a... I don't know. Being born in 1970, I can't say this, but I always got the impression that the Stones were kind of a band whose music would have been heard by people in Vietnam for the U.S. Of the period of the late 60s and early 70s. And it's not tuneful and melodic like the Beatles. It's harder and rougher. And that I just think. Yeah, I think in terms of time and in terms of tone, it was always like code for Vietnam, at least in America, it was the Stones.
And you can't use the Doors because they use those in Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Right. And it's jagged and jangly, and it puts you on edge. I mean, they're not going to play Hey You Get Off My Cloud. They're going to play Paint It Black.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They're going to play Sympathy for the Devil.
Exactly.
Little Red Rooster.
Yeah. So yeah. I think you're right, though. I think it is an American shorthand for Vietnam a little bit, for some Vietnam flavor, from the late 60s flavor. Or early 70s is the Stones. I think so. Because it keeps happening.
I don't know. Yeah, it just always like, you know, why not Led Zeppelin, for example? Mm. It just, it always struck me as a bit weird.
I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, it's a really bad cover in the version in Mr. Lap.
And also, another person wandering around with music, he's got an M16. Not even an Uzi this time, but an M16.
So Lance LeGault is over the hill on his helicopter taking pictures of them like a paparazzo or something. And one of the ones that they're like, oh, and get a load of this guy. And we didn't get a good picture of him and all that. And I keep waiting for them to put down the picture where he's just toting his giant machine gun. And they never do. I'm like, no, he's a nut. He's a nut with a giant machine gun.
Well, And then later
go
on,
arrest
they're like,
him.
And here's, hey, take that surveillance picture that you got the other day. And it's just, it's like a mugshot or a headshot for a theater.
The studio quality 10x8 that they suddenly have that scanned in the computer.
It's his 8x10 headshot, yeah.
Yes, my name is Nuzo. I'll be auditioning for the role of El Guapo in The Fantastics.
No Russian accents. That's my only demand. I can't play a Russian.
Wow.
Apparently, they can also play Dungeons and Dragons on the computer. So, you know, why wouldn't they be able to merge two extremely high resolution photos? Mm.
That's right.
Navy computers are like that. They can do that.
Oh, man.
Okay, we should
Navy
talk.
Computers are going to help him win that Molokai to Oahu race, too, remember?
Yeah, he's training. TC, you know, he could go out and come back in, but why not just have your friend in the helicopter drop you? Anyway, okay, the end. We should talk about the end, because this is the big thing. So Ivan is going to get off scot-free. Ivan tried to kill Magnum, did kill Mac. Set this thing in motion with Nuzo, who is a Russian plant, to have TC basically die and or assassinate the Japanese prince or both. And he's going to, due to, you know, the diplomats, and he talks about how the admiral wasn't a fan of it either, but they basically, the State Department doesn't want to make a big deal about it. They're going to code him as a diplomat from Bulgaria or whatever, send him back to the Eastern Bloc. He's going to skate. And in response, and this is more than I remembered from back in the day, in response, Magnum and Rick set a trap. Rick blocks a road, stopping his limo. Magnum pulls him out of the limo, marches into the jungle. They have a conversation which ends with the classic, aha, Magnum, you will not kill me because I know you too well. At least he doesn't say we're not so much alike, you and I.
In another world, we could have been friends.
Exactly, but he does say you're not gonna do it because you're a good guy, and that's why I win. And he walks away. And of course, in that famous moment, Magnum says, "Ivan, did you see the sunrise this morning?" And then the last frame freezes as Magnum shoots him in cold blood, and that's the end. Now, this is famous. I have a bunch of questions, which is what happens to the driver, what happens to the car, Do they go back and like ask Higgins how to dissolve a body? What it is? Did he just shoot him like in the shoulder and say, "Okay, now we're even, Ivan," and then let him get back in his limo? It's never really spoken of again. I have a lot of questions about the disposition of Ivan's body.
They just take Rick's... him up in the chopper and drop him onto one of those massive, cliff mountains that they have.
I like to imagine that he drags Ivan's body back out to the road, and Rick is dragged the limo driver's body into the car, which they then drive off of a cliff somewhere.
Yeah, but the consulate is in this very remote part of Oahu, because they're like on a dirt road near so already, I mean, hiding the body, I don't think it'll be a problem. I guess he got out, went for a hike, shouldn't have done that before his flight.
Yeah.
But no, I assume the driver, the minute Magnum disappeared and Rick heard the gunshot, he just blackjacked that driver in the back of the head. And left.
Now, I will say again, I don't expect this from American TV very often. They did a very nice job of, you know, TC comes in and says, "Rick, I need your wheels." Or Orville, I'm sorry. "Orville, I need your wheels." And then when they're looking for Rick's car, there aren't that many Mercedes on the island.
Right.
You know, how many can there be? And so then when you see this car parked blocking the road, and the camera comes around and you see the Mercedes logo before you even see that it's Rick. And it's just nicely
set up
for you.
Yeah.
One thing about the ending that I should mention is that in the UK, and I'm told this in retrospect, I don't remember because it was so long ago, but in the UK transmission, they didn't show the actual gunshot. What you got really? Was him turning round, raising the gun, and then smashed to black, and you heard the gunshot.
Oh, interesting.
So similar to the end of something like Blake 7.
So was that out of concern for local
like gun
customs at the times? Did you not was gunplay not allowed to be shown on TV?
It's not it was absolutely. We had shows like The Professionals, which had people you know like gunning one another down all over the place. But I think the difference is that Magnum was a primetime Saturday evening show.
Okay,
as I recall, you know, sort of literally shown at like 7 o'clock in the evening or something. It wasn't a late night show. And so, yes, it was probably a pre-Watershed Think of the Children thing. Again, not guns per se, but the fact that it is Cold Blood. The fact that he is it's so out of character for a square-jawed American hero. But the thing is, it didn't matter.
No.
Like, this is the futility of censorship. It didn't matter because we knew what had happened. You don't need to see the gun flash. You know what's happened. And we were all still blown away by it and still talking about it in the playground the next day as if we had. You know, it's like the cutting off the ear in Reservoir Dogs or something. It doesn't actually matter whether you show it or not. You know that it's there. And so it has the same impact.
So how do we all feel today looking back on this at Magnum, you know, Magnum cutting this guy down in Cold Blood? You know, we'll assume that he shot him like not in the leg or something.
No, shot him dead, man.
Uh-huh.
Took an arrow to the knee.
Ivan is quite dead.
Yep. So how do we feel about it? This is our hero, and he killed a guy. Again, a really bad guy who did a lot of really bad things and is going to, because of the governments and everything, is going to get away. And our hero decides he's not going to let him get away, leads him out into the jungle, and guns him down.
Since we now live in the era of anti-hero television, where, you know, a math teacher who makes meth can be the hero of a TV show, or a member of a crime family is the hero of the TV show. Maybe less impactful if you were watching this for the first time today. It still works for me, and I still don't have a problem with it. If I have a criticism, I wish that future episodes of Magnum would have built on that element of Magnum's character, that when push comes to a shove, he will do what one has to do in these situations.
Believers in retribution. I mean, it's really difficult from my point of view to answer that question, because we were so used, even then, to American shows where everybody's just firing guns left, right and center. In, of course, you know, a country where firearms are banned, where we don't have guns, and we don't have TV shows of cops and detectives running around firing guns all over the place. There were exceptions like The Sweeney and The Professionals, like I say, but they were very much not the majority of shows. And so to us, like, it was shocking in terms of Magnum's character, but the idea of, oh yes, it's okay to be a vigilante and take retribution and kill the bad guys if you know they're bad, in the context of watching an American show, wasn't actually all that, or didn't seem at the time anyway, all that unusual to us. But like I say, it's all relative, because, you know, it's like I said, we didn't have that sort of thing at all. The idea of ultimate retribution to us, even the hanging death penalty had been abolished, you know, decades before. So we just didn't have that at all in our culture.
For me, it's just the shocking thing is that Magnum does it, right? It is a character thing,
yeah,
right? That he's our hero, and we expect him to be a hero. He's never been played as an anti-hero or a cop on the edge or anything like that. He's got this history, and we see that it's darker than maybe we anticipated before this episode. But to have him, this lighthearted guy who's just out, you know, Vietnam veteran and prisoner of war and all that, but now he's just paddling around in the channel trying to get his 6-mile paddle in. And by the end of the episode, he's just shooting a guy in cold blood. It's a shocker from a character standpoint.
I didn't mind it at the time because it made sense intellectually, right? You know, okay, this is the only way he's going to be able to do this. And watching it today, I can say, all right, well, TC was clearly not the only person he had set up as a trigger. You know, we didn't plan the timing. We didn't plan the target. We only set up the trigger. And I can see him making the rationalization that, look, I, you know, yes, I'm getting retribution for this, but I'm also preventing him from having that effect on anyone else that he set up. And it's like,
sure,
oh,
but,
all right.
But that's, you know, that's the whole argument about, like, are you going to prejudge somebody for a crime that hasn't yet been committed? And
right.
emotionally,
right.
you can say, well, yes, of course, but that's not how the law works.
Right, right.
But this is what marks a show like this out. Again, to an 11-year-old kid watching it, you know, in his mm-hmm. bedroom or whatever. This is what marks a show like this out from your Red, White, and Blue Superman, you know, type characters,
right.
where they have the shades of grey and the darker side, and sometimes will do things that you know are morally wrong, but nevertheless feel like they're the right thing to do.
I also say, you know, contrasting with something like the A-Team, where there was a lot of gunfire, but nobody ever got shot.
Hot lead
basically.
Everywhere, nobody, right. yeah, not a scratch.
The worst shots in the army.
Yeah.
Well, because they were being chased.
They were
being chased.
A unit who couldn't hit a bull in the butt with a bag of rice.
Because they were being chased by Lance LeGault.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the contrast too, right? Is that here it matters. These are, you know, the violence acts have impact. The Mac dies when the car blows up. And here Magnum is shooting
Even
him.
Julie's
he doesn't
badly
miss.
Injured. Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't miss. David, were you saying before we got started that you've Zaprudered the Mac explosion? They didn't actually blow up a Ferrari.
They didn't actually blow up a Ferrari. They blew up a Fiat. Which
Italian
close enough,
begins with an F.
I guess. It's dark. It's a little bit of a distance. They blow it up. But yeah, it's. You know, it's a very awkwardly shot sequence. And that also bugged me at the time. I was like, that's not the same car. Mm. But, you know, I've never been like, oh, let's slow it down. Let's zoom, you know, to
the Ferrari deaths may have been more shocking than Max. Mac was only a recurring character.
Oh, yeah. We barely knew Mac, but yeah.
the Ferrari.
And the Ferrari was the fifth character.
And they both had lookalikes that returned to the show. So it's
that's
fine.
That's right. They just bought a new model of Mac.
And you've got to take it in context. Like, even as a kid, I was aware of things like TV budgets. You know, you've got the stock footage of is it a missile launch or something in this?
Oh, that's such a terrible, terrible insert shot.
Even as a kid, you can tell that it's a horrible stock footage thing, you know, much like the missile blowing up the mountain that they had in Airwolf, or the three MiGs exploding that they used for the entire run of the series.
And speaking of Airwolf, Don Belisario must really have a thing for helicopters, you know?
Sure.
Because all of his episodes feature the helicopters a lot, and then he went off and created Airwolf.
Maybe he got a discount from the helicopter flying service,
so,
where it's
maybe.
Like, okay, and, if you do three shows about helicopters, you can amortize the cost.
At the very least, just from the episodes we've watched for this, he really has a thing for having Roger Mosley say, Koho Olave.
Oh, yes.
Over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
Koho Olave. Here we go again.
So last time I was in Hawaii, we stayed in Maui, and we were down where our condo that we were renting had a view not only of the water, but of Koho Olave. And I, the whole time,
oh,
I'm just like, I know all about that island. Why? Magnum P.I. And as we watch these episodes, I'm like, there it is again, Koho Olave. They don't actually do missile firing. Like, Koho Olave has been given back basically to the native Hawaiians, and there's this whole procedure where they have to like get all the unexploded ordnance out of it and try to maybe restore it to a ecologically better kind of place. It's dry and no life really can exist there. But, you know, but at the time, the U.S. military just fired missiles into this Hawaiian island for kicks, and that's what it's always mentioned in Magnum. Yeah,
when TC's flying Magnum out at the start to do the paddling thing, he was flying like past the landscape. There were parts of it where I was like, oh, I recognize that. No, hey, I've never been to Hawaii. Oh, Apple TV screensavers.
Sure. Right? Yeah. Right. And if you've seen any of the show, like, have you seen Lost? There's a Magnum has hexagon thing on his wall when he comes into his apartment. And every time I think that he's a Lost Dharma station from,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's Hawaii. It's all just connected somehow.
I was going to say, wasn't Don Belisario a Marine himself? So
I think that, so, yeah.
That might explain the obsession with choppers, mightn't it?
Yeah, could be.
Yeah. And, I mean, there's an episode of Vegas from, like, the year before Magnum came on where it's the helicopter, it's Robin's Nest, it's all there.
Yeah,
it's just not Magnum.
Just trying it out. I like the Island Hopper's van, by the way, because I like to imagine, having been a tourist in Hawaii many times, I do like to imagine all about TC's business and how he's got like tours that he gives where he drives you around. Like, we're going to go over here. We're going to stop at the Pali Lookout. We're going to go over to Windward. We're going to go down to Wailea. We're going to come back. You know, then you're going to get in the chopper. We're going to have a lunch. We got a little some sandwiches here. You can make your own lunch, and then you get on the chopper, and we're going to take you over here, and then you get on a boat, and like, I like to imagine that TC's got it all rigged, where he's got a whole thing. You got a kayak rental here. My
friend
Thomas.
We're going to stop and murder the Japanese prince because I've been drugged.
That's right.
I mean, that truth is extra.
Nobody connect Island Hoppers with the guy who tried to kill the Japanese prince. Okay, just, it's bad for business.
Yeah, that Yelp rating's going right down.
Or that one who died in the airport. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong throughout the rest of the series, but like, TC is basically the guy who actually runs a successful business, who has actually made something of himself. Yes. Rick doesn't. And no, he's Magnum just a basically lucked into a cushy number. TC is the one guy who actually, of that lot, who went, no, I'm a successful self-made businessman.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think Rick is good, like, with people, and so he's probably banking some money away, but he's also, yeah, he's just doing restaurants, and he has underworld connections and all of those things. But,
well, and running books.
Yeah, exactly.
Illegal books and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, sure. So he's not afraid to get his hands a little dirty, but he's probably salting some money away somewhere, unless he's got a horrible gambling addiction or something, which he might. But you're right, TC's got Island Hoppers. I mean, maybe Island Hoppers could be bigger if he brought on more, like, you know, more employees and stuff. But he's had
more than two vehicles.
Yes, he's made his way with a van and a helicopter.
Buddy wasn't always commandeering his helicopter to go.
Well, you do get the sense that TC is not as busy as he could be, right? Because he's able to just shuttle Magnum around somewhere. Although I will say, a little bit like the transporter on Star Trek, having TC and the helicopter is really good for the script.
Magnum,
because they can get him anywhere. They can get him to another island. They can get him fast from point A to point B. It's like super convenient to have TC on call. So, yeah.
Although these days they wouldn't even bother with that. You watch a show like NCIS LA is the one that always cracks me up.
Oh my God.
And
yeah,
like, those guys literally get from, they solve an entire case in a day, and that case involved them driving across Los Angeles 10 times.
Right,
you're like,
exactly.
That's not, no.
Yeah.
Which is Belisario adjacent, because NCIS LA is a spinoff of NCIS, which he created, which is a spinoff of JAG.
In our family, there's a legendary story. My wife went to Virginia Tech, which is in Blacksburg, Virginia, and which is about a 4-hour drive from the DC area.
Mm-hmm.
There's an episode of JAG where JAG has been thrown out of the JAG, and to make
it. But his name is JAG.
His name is JAG.
How can he get thrown out?
Yeah, and he is flying planes in Blacksburg. That's how he's making his ends meet. And my wife is watching this and having kittens, because this is ridiculous. And my dad, who lived his life according to JAG's teachings and has seen every episode of JAG, watches that and goes, no, you're wrong. Blacksburg is very close to Northern Virginia. And my wife is, I went to my school in Blacksburg. And so there was a lot of that will actually come up every day.
I am reminded of Fringe, which was set partially in Boston and partially in New York, and in the parallel universe of Fringe, both of them, that's like a really short, that's like a 10-minute drive. Fringe episodes where they're like, they're in Boston, they're in New York, they're back in Boston. It's like, how did that happen? And it's like,
there's a tunnel.
Yep.
Very fast trains.
The Acela tunnel from Boston. The Acela, it now goes 400 miles an hour. It's amazing. What have we not talked about Did You See the Sunrise?
James Whitmore Jr., who plays Sebastian Nuzzo, went on to become a very famous TV director. And his dad is, of course, James Whitmore Sr., who played Harry Truman in Give 'Em Hell, Harry, and also Brooks in Shawshank Redemption.
I liked the implication that Buck Green does not trust 5-0, which is another reason why Buck Green is an idiot. Because apparently 5-0 is full of leaks. If you want everyone to know from one end of the island to the other, It's like, yeah, okay, sure. I also liked when Magnum and Julie are driving to their date and the camera kind of comes around and you see that she's sitting on Mac's lap in the Ferrari, which, I mean, that's just odd to begin with. But then as they're having this conversation and it finally Magnum literally breaks the fourth wall and just stares right at the camera, which is one of the few times he does it in the series intentionally like that. And it's hilarious. I love that. And they hold on it too.
That. I remember him breaking the fourth wall as being something that happened fairly often, but like I said, again, without details, I had the impression.
It happened from time to time, but this one was, it usually wasn't when other people were aware of him, right?
This is like,
there's nowhere to hide. You know, he's just like, can you believe this?
Yeah, no, he literally stares at the camera for several seconds and then looks away.
If you treat this as it's basically Magnum telling his adventures to someone, then like this is the point in the story where he's like staring at the person he's telling the story to and goes,
can you believe this?
And again, thank God that he didn't have any narration. They just let it. They trusted the audience.
But I do like the narration. I was going to say that I'm not generally someone who loves like lots of voiceover and stuff. But with Magnum, because every time it is kind of this noir detective kind of thing that's going on. And here it's so effective because he's counting the sunrises. And so you can get that in there. And I love the Magnum narration. It's probably ruined me and made me like narration way more than I should because it's generally not very good. It's good here.
You got to have narration in a noir. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like having swords in a fantasy series or something. You know, it's going to happen.
You know, and Tom Selleck is more handsome than your average noir detective, but he is. He does get, like in this episode, he's got that thing on his forehead for the whole episode. He gets beat up. That's one of the reasons I said it in the first episode that we love Magnum is that, like Indiana Jones, he's a hero who is human and he is fallible and he gets the crap beat out of him and he just keeps going, which you gotta root for him there. And he is, you know, in this unlikely setting, he is that, you know, rumpled detective in a way.
Well, and was it Chandler who gave the definition of like the noir detective is, you know, the best man in a terrible world or something. And you know, that's what Magnum is in this. I mean, putting aside TC and Rick, who actually are probably better than him.
Right. The other Chandler line you know, a man walks down these mean streets who is not himself mean. Right. That's another great definition of Magnum.
Yeah.
You know, he's a nice guy. I was also watching the end credits for the first half of this, because they don't ever introduce the MC at Luau Louis. Apparently the MC's name is Happy Ho.
Yes, sure. Mm-hmm. Of course
and
it
that
is.
Just cracked me up. I just lost it.
I mean, I will have to take it on faith that tourist traps like that existed, but my God, that's the pits, that place.
I have been to a Hawaiian luau, but I think they at least make an attempt to make it feel more authentic than what we see at that one. But I think it effectively gets across the tourist trap luau too. I'm sure it's probably a little extreme, but also it really does get across like this place is terrible.
Well, I kind of like the idea that Mac wouldn't like the good tourist trap places. Even it would be this really trashy, awful place.
Actually, as somebody who grew up in sort of tourist places and lives in a touristy kind of place, I do know that it's a real thing that locals. There are some tourist traps that locals like, and often they like it for one specific reason. And like everybody else is like, oh, I go there for the whole luau experience. And Mac is like, I go there for the drinks that they put in the pineapple. I like that pineapple thing. And like, that's why he's there. That's why he goes. And I think there is some authenticity to that, that if you're a local, you're like, well, this is a tourist trap, but it's got this thing about it. Like I knew
it's got one thing that works.
Yeah.
And also isn't there that throwaway shot where he sees like one of the girls in the dance line and he kind of waves at her and she gives him this look like, oh, good. You're here.
It's him.
Oh, yeah. Him again.
Good,
it's you.
Right. Right. Because you're working at a tourist trap. There are never any regulars, but this guy is a regular. Yeah.
And I do like, again, you know, it's a Buck Green episode that means something very specific. But I like that when he's at Luau Louis and Mac looks over And he goes, oh, I have to get up and go over there for a minute. And we find out that all of this is not really, you know, Mac is not being court-martialed. He's not really resigning. There's something else going on. But we know that because Buck Green is involved, it's going to get screwed up.
Yeah.
And, but it's nice.
And it's
nice.
And his leverage is because Mac has helped Magnum, right? That's the leverage he has over him.
Right.
Yeah, that he could get court-martialed, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, they soft-pedaled that because that would be a very easy way for Magnum to be incredibly guilty about Mac dying, right? And they don't quite go all that way. Like, Maggie says that he didn't want to do it, but it's like, Buck Green doesn't say, the only reason he got into this is because you were, you know, because of you, Magnum. He kind of hints at it, but he doesn't say it outright. I think because maybe they were concerned that that was a little too hard on Magnum to have him be completely culpable in his friend being killed.
Because that would also make the audience complicit then, because in all those previous times when he has hassled Mac to help him, the audience has been on Magnum's side.
Come on, Mac. Gotta help out Magnum. Oh, no, they killed Mac. No.
Yeah.
Anything else? All right.
I got nothing.
All right. Well, this is, you know, it's nice to talk about this because on that day, I didn't go, you know, on October 1st of 1982, I didn't have anybody on the playground to talk about Do You See the Sunrise? So I'm glad that we finally got to talk about it. He shoots the guy at the end. It really happened.
Did you
before
see that?
We go.
Oh, my God.
Can't believe
before
it.
Before we go.
Yes, David.
Did you see the sunrise this morning?
I actually didn't. I slept in.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, me too.
I've been to the Pali Lookout, though.
Too old. Too old to stay up on sea sunrises now. Good Lord.
Well, that's less effective, though.
Did you see the mid-afternoon sun today?
Yeah, I did. It was very bright.
Very nice.
You died in vain, Mac.
Well, until the next sunrise, Anthony, thank you so much for being on Magnum Podcast.
Thank you for having me on. I apologize for having removed all the comedy from the show, but I really did want to come on and talk about this episode because I love it so much.
David, Jay Lohr, and Philip Michaels, thanks, guys.
Removing all the comedy, I'm just going to stare at the camera for a minute.
Must waste now!
And this is the part where I look at Anthony and then shoot him over a freeze frame.
Seems legit.
Yeah, exactly. Just a guest star, not a recurring guest.
Well, wait till my identical cousin comes back.
Exactly right. And then,
oh, my God.
And then Ranthony Johnson shows up and it's like, what?
You will never leave the Ferrari. Ever again.
I'm going to call you Mantony.
Johnny Ranston.
yes. There you go.